Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. When you hear about non-native or alien species of plants or animals, it's usually because they're causing a problem. But there's some new thinking out there. Not all of these invasive species are necessarily bad. The labels non-native, alien, and invasive may mean very different things, and the wildlife they describe can help or hurt a specific environment. Kansas City has its own share of contentious plants and animals, and not every conservationist agrees on what they mean for our land. Journalist Fred Pierce is with us today. He's the author of The New Wild, Why Invasive Species Will Be Nature's Salvation. He joins us from his home in the UK. And Fred, good morning.
Good morning.
Larry Rizzo is here in the studio with me. He's a natural history biologist for the Missouri Department of Conservation here in Kansas City. Larry, welcome back. Nice to have you again.
Good morning, Steve.
Ryan Armbrost is a forest health and conservation forester at the Kansas Forest Service. He joins us from his office in Manhattan. And Ryan, good morning to you.
Good morning, Steve.
Ryan, excuse the opening question here, but Kansas has a forest service? I mean, help me there. Where's the forest?
We checked on the tree last week, and it's doing quite well.
Where is that tree, Ryan?
Well, we've actually got about 2.5 million acres of hardwood forest in the eastern third of Kansas. So surprisingly, we do have quite a significant forest resource here.
So this is not a typo on my script here. There really is a Kansas Forest Service.
Correct.
Okay. Well, Fred, you're going to flip a lot of conventional wisdom this morning on its ear here. Most of us are conditioned to think of non-native species as this enormous threat. I'm thinking zebra mussels. But your message is that everyone should relax. Tell me why.
I think we've got them wrong. I think many of them, I don't say they never cause us problems and they don't give difficulties. And if you're fighting a newly arrived disease in the forests of Kansas or anywhere else, you've got a problem. So I don't say they never cause us problems, but what I say is in the big scheme of things, in the big scheme of nature, migrant species, colonist species are the kind of go-getters. They are the species that can do things that maybe native species can't do, and especially they move in when humans mess up the environment. So very often they're not part of the solution. They're not part of the problem to our kind of ecological collapse that we're seeing in much of the world. They're part of the solution. They're nature's response to the problems. And I think we need to think of them more in that light. So you talk about zebra mussels. Yeah, they've caused us some problems on water intakes and jetties and that kind of thing. But if you remember what they first arrived in Lake Erie was dead then. It was a real, mess of stuff, of pollution. You couldn't see down through the water. They cleaned it up quite substantially. And quite a few fisheries have done quite well in the Great Lakes as a result. So they have some downsides, but they also have some upsides. We tend to forget about those. But also, I think they are part of nature's go-getting instincts. They're part of evolution happening right now in response to the threats that nature faces, many of them threats from humans. So we need to think about that. It's not that they don't cause problems for us, but they are nature red in tooth and claw, if you like. They're nature doing its stuff. And conservationists should remember that.
Huh. Well, Larry Rizzo, again, from the Missouri Department of Conservation, I'm told that maybe some definitions might be in order here very early in our program. Tell me what the difference is between a non-native species and an invasive species, and what are we talking about here?
Sure, Steve. I think it's very important to make these distinctions, and the two sentences I always give to groups when I'm speaking on this topic is that not all exotic species are invasive, and not all invasive species are exotic. And that sounds extremely confusing, but if I can explain,
yeah,
for instance,
please.
A native species that's invasive would be the eastern red cedar. It's a fine plant, a fine tree in its own right. It's great for wildlife. Where it belongs, it's very beneficial. We're not trying to eradicate it from our landscape, but we have special natural communities, for instance, called glades, and some of our prairies, too, where that gets a foothold. It takes over, totally shades and crowds out everything native. So we have to get rid of them. So it's an invasive species, even though it's native. It's fire prone. It will be killed with fire. So its proliferation is really a reflection of how natural disturbances on the landscape don't take place anymore, like they once did prior to European settlement when fires kept it under control. So it's an invasive species, even though it's native. And then we have many, many exotic species that don't cause us problems. 30% of the flora of Missouri, the naturalized flora of Missouri, is exotic. And by no means is anyone saying that all those species are a problem. Mm-hmm. But the invasive ones are. And invasive we use as a term as a species that invades our natural communities and crowds out or outcompetes the natives. So it leads to an overall decline in biological diversity, and that's where the problem comes in.
I was going to say, what if you didn't do anything? You didn't deal with these red cedars that you're telling us about, Larry. What would happen?
Well, in the situations, the natural communities where they're a problem, for instance, our glades and prairies, there's a flora there that has to have sunlight, and they simply crowd that out. And so you would wind up with a cedar thicket in place of a natural community that might contain 200 to 300 species of plants in some cases. Mm-hmm. So it would be a significant loss in biological diversity. And when you lose things like that, what you're doing is losing the specialists.
Mm-hmm.
You're not losing the generalist species, you're losing the specialists. There are insects and plants that have very close relationships that they've developed over, you know, thousands and tens of thousands of years of evolution. And you're replacing them with the generalist species, the starlings of the world and the ragweeds of the world.
So I wanted to ask both you and Ryan then, Larry, do you take any issue with what Fred Barnes is talking about? Again, he's the author of The New Wild, Why Invasive Species Will Be Nature's Salvation. What do you make about what he's saying to us?
Well, I take issue with the terminology. Invasive species they're not a good thing. And it's just that simple. If you replace that with the word exotic, I certainly can listen to that, and mm-hmm. I appreciate what he's saying. I'm not an aquatic biologist, so I don't want to get out over my skis too much, but what he describes with the zebra mussels, you must also keep in mind that clearing of the water is also an effect of sucking all the nutrients out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Nutrient-poor systems are clear in the Ozarks. Our Ozark streams are nutrient-poor, so that makes it beautiful, clear water. But that's not necessarily a good thing in all places. And there have been some benefits to zebra mussels for some species, but mm-hmm. we don't want to take that too far.
Ryan Armbrost, again, with the Kansas Forest Service, weigh in here. What do you make of what Fred is saying? What are your concerns about invasive species?
Yeah, I think Fred's perspective is very interesting, and I think it's important to, you know, to step back and reconsider the paradigm of what it is we consider to be a beneficial plant, whether it's, regionally native, whether it's native to the last 10,000 years, native before the Ice Ages, native to this continent. I think that there are a lot of situations where we can look at a plant that is perhaps evolved in a different ecosystem somewhere hundreds of miles from where it's currently planted, and it's doing some very significant ecosystem services. A great example, I think, of out here in the working forest part of the Great Plains, we've got a lot of windbreaks that Oriental arborvitae is a very important component of and tolerates our site conditions well and doesn't represent the sort of freely seeding proliferation threat that some other species do, mm-hmm. specifically our native red cedar. As Larry mentioned, but I think there are some very notorious examples of exotic species that are very, very thuggish and rapidly invade and deteriorate ecosystems by creating monocultures, by forcing out some of our natives that support other components of that ecosystem, that support all the insects and birds and other wildlife that are of that whole system. One of the ones I'm most concerned about is bush honeysuckle, which really shows us how we as humans can have some unintended consequences and blowback from
mm-hmm.
and otherwise pristine intentions of helping with conservation, helping wildlife, and it hasn't turned out quite how we thought it would several decades ago.
Well, so just to be clear here, both Ryan and Larry, you're both saying that some invasive species are in fact an issue. Ryan, am I hearing that correctly?
Yeah, I absolutely agree, and I think Larry's point on the difference between exotics and invasives is well made, and there are some invasive exotic species that we deal with significantly in the Great Plains and in Missouri that I think we can pretty clearly point at and say unequivocally they've led to some degradation of that habitat, of that
mm-hmm.
ecosystem. Sure, they might live there, and they might be filling a role, but it's probably a lower quality role than the native species that were there.
Well, Fred Pierce, you're stirring things up here a little bit. Respond to what you're hearing from our two naturalists here right from my own backyard here in Kansas City. What do you make about what they're saying?
Well, I think we're agreeing about a certain amount, for sure. I think we're agreeing importantly on the distinction between aliens and invasives. As has been said, native species can be, you know, the ones that we're used to, the ones that we have around the yard all the time, can be very invasive, can be very dangerous. Whereas the majority of alien species that come in, they just kind of settle down and they move in. One of the problems that we have is, if you like, the caricaturing of foreign species. We can get almost kind of xenophobic about them, and the language that we use about them can sometimes be rather unhelpful, and it suggests, rather in the way that some humans will suggest, that all foreigners are, you know, trouble, and we should keep them out. They will kind of talk in the same kind of language about foreign species, and I don't think that's very helpful. Mm-hmm. We should treat species, you know, as we find them. I don't think there's anything intrinsically bad about an alien, but some of the thinking in ecology traditionally and in conservation circles today gives us the view that aliens, outsiders, are of themselves almost by definition bad. Mm-hmm. Some ecologists, when they're counting the number of species, when they're measuring biodiversity, refuse to count alien species because they say they're not native and therefore they can only be destructive. Mm-hmm. And I think that's wrong. In most ecosystems, most of the time, outside species can fit in, they can find a role, they can find a place, they add to biodiversity. If you think, you know, America has more species than it had before Europeans turned up from the old world, about a quarter more probably, by most counts. So all these invasive species that arrived haven't caused mass extinctions locally, they've just simply added to the number of species. It's the more the merrier, maybe. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a matter of perspective. It's a matter of, there's a lot of new thinking going on in ecology, saying that, you know, local ecosystems are not perfected. They haven't evolved to some perfect state in the way that ecologists used to think they did.
I was going to say,
they're much more kind of dynamic and changing. You know, they're moving on. They're constantly adapting to new things, including climate change. So, you know, we need to bear that in mind.
I think that's how a lot of people view ecosystems, as they're this this perfect evolution that's the result of centuries upon centuries of time and development. Am I right, Fred?
Yeah, that's right. But that's a common view. But Charles Darwin, when he was developing his theories about evolution, he certainly never thought that they reached some kind of state of perfection.
Yeah.
The climax ecosystem, as some ecologists still talk about. He just said, you know, species were just adapting and evolving for their own benefit, and that whole ecosystems were also constantly changing. So that gives us a different kind of view, I think, about how nature is. Mm-hmm. So, you know, alien species coming in are not of themselves bad. They may sometimes have bad effects, but they're not of themselves bad. They're just, you know, other species coming in. They may be very good for ecosystems. They may provide new ecosystem services. They may, in a world where the humans have, you know, where we've messed up a lot of landscapes,
right,
they could be very beneficial. I'm very interested in the stories that are coming out of Puerto Rico, for instance, where humans just basically destroyed most of the forests there with farming. Then they gave up, abandoned the fields. And the species that moved back in, that reclaimed the old forest lands, were not the native species. They were incomer species. The African tulip tree is now the most important tree in Puerto Rico. It's colonizing. It's doing a good job. It's reclaiming the near desert that the farmers had created.
Right.
So we need to think about species this way, I think.
I want to get our listeners involved here. We're talking about non-native species, invasive species on the show today, and the threat threat or the lack of a threat that they pose. 816-235-2888 is our phone number. Again, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. And Larry Rizzo with the Missouri Department of Conservation, I wanted to ask you about an email we just got. Stephanie has an example of what we're talking about here. Former owners of a Midtown Kansas City house, he planted a bamboo fence. I'm sure it looked just lovely at first, Stephanie writes, but it rapidly is encroaching on the entire yard. It's apparently literally impossible to get rid of. Wouldn't call this a beneficial species, at least not in this context, not in Midtown Kansas City backyard. What about it?
Well, that is a good example of, let's say, a localized invasive species there. Mm-hmm. And I know of many situations where people have used the ornamental bamboos and experience that. What people, I think, sometimes don't realize is bamboo's a grass, so it spreads rhizomatically and just keeps on going, and it is kind of a nasty thing to control. Now, down in southern Missouri, we have native bamboo along some of our streams, and that's certainly a beneficial plant. It used to take up some fairly large landscapes in southeast Missouri once upon a time, but I'm guessing the species she's planted in landscaping is not that native one, but a different one. I see it around. It gets 20 feet high.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to ask Ryan, too. You know, we've got all kinds of things growing here in the U.S. that were not here, you know, when the first European explorers arrived. I'm thinking about wheat, no less, you know, as I look at all this, Ryan. But I don't hear much of an outcry about it, at least about it not being native to Kansas. What about wheat, Ryan?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I think we all have to consider, you know, it's not just the point that Fred made is well made. It's not just that since a plant isn't from here, it's necessarily good or bad. But wheat, certainly, at least we have some justification for, you know, that as being a grain crop and going towards into the human food system. But I'd like to actually just, you know, touch on the idea of the bamboo versus what else was growing in the backyard. And I would actually, to play devil's advocate, make the point that perhaps that bamboo is better than the high-input, low-service turf that it could potentially be invading.
Because why? So, tell me about that.
Well, at least at that point, it could provide some cover for birds. It could provide a little bit more moisture-holding capacity, could stabilize the soil more. It could require fewer inputs as far as nitrogen. It perhaps would have less nitrate runoff than a typical turf situation. So perhaps, you know, just to play devil's advocate, maybe that bamboo is actually better than the turf. Now, if that bamboo is forcing out a beautiful native perennial garden that supports 50 species of Lepidoptera, you know, butterflies, maybe it's not a good thing. But I don't think there is a black and white here, for sure.
Well, Larry, Ryan's point is really interesting, because on this show we've talked about this any number of times, this notion of the nice golf putting green lawn that so many people are after. We're really sort of reaching and stretching what we can naturally support with the lawns that we have in so many of our yards, right?
Sure. Lawns are really sort of an ecological nightmare if you really want to look at it that
Tell
way.
Tell me about it. And I live with it.
Ryan's point is a decent one, other than I would say your average homeowner looks at the bamboo and says, I can't walk on it barefoot. That's one of the big problems. But yeah, the chemical inputs, people, we have an aesthetic of our lawns that's it would certainly be nice to change the inputs of fertilizers and pesticides to achieve that perfect green lawn with only one species of grass in it. It really does a lot of harm in the overall sense, and it certainly doesn't provide much of a benefit for a while. It's not a whole lot better than asphalt, other than the infiltration of water.
No better than asphalt, Larry. That's going to hit a lot of
people
hard.
From a biological standpoint, other than water can soak into it. That's its best ecological benefit in many ways.
Okay, the threat of non-native species, plants, animals, that's our topic here. 816-235-2888. Let's go to Philip from Miriam on the Kansas side. Philip, good morning.
Hey, Steve. Thanks so much. Great topic.
Good.
I'm just curious. I'm glad Fred Pierce mentioned Charles Darwin. I'm curious if you remember a movie about 10 years ago called Darwin's Nightmare.
Oh, yeah.
About some fish that were introduced in East Africa, and just the way that they just really took over this lake. Lake Victoria is back, the largest lake. in Africa, just absolutely taking over. And then that brings to mind here in this country just the way Asian carp are taking over some rivers and lakes, and it's a real problem. So my question is, who decides, you know, to introduce these exotics? And really the balance of nature is really set off by, you know, someone bringing over just a bucket of fish in their backyard, and they get sick of the fish, and they put them in the lake,
yeah,
you know, nearby. And so it's really, you know, a big question, like who decides to start this chain of reaction of imbalance?
Well, Philip, congratulations. You've just stolen about 8 of my questions here I was going to get to here. That's such a good point. Larry, tell us about Asian carp, the Missouri River. You know, these are the fish I've read you drive down in a motorboat on the Missouri River, and these things are jumping out of the water and whacking people upside of the head, and these are obviously an invasive species.
Right. Yeah, and the short answer to his very good question is most of these species don't get here by conscious decision, at least anymore. Perhaps once upon a time they did, but there's several species of these Asian carp that are a problem, and one of them, for a fact, I know is often attributed to escapes from a hatchery,
mm-hmm.
That kind of thing. The zebra mussel, of course, came in ballast water and ships, so it certainly wasn't anything.
Attached to the bottom of ships, you're saying. Yeah.
Right, and they released their ballast water in the Great Lakes, so it certainly wasn't anything intentional. But the Asian carp are a huge problem, because the one thing we must remember is that they're eating something, and they're taking nutrients away from the native fish population, and they're just sheer numbers are staggering.
And the ultimate threat to that river is what, Larry?
Well, that's a tough question. The ultimate threat to the Missouri River was pretty much what we did to it when we channelized it and straightened it. We have done a pretty good job in some cases of trying to reverse some of our quote-unquote engineering of the river as far as providing backwaters and slack waters and notching dikes and things like that. But the Missouri River, the lower Missouri River especially, is not going to ever be what it once was when it was a mile wide and braided and shallow and had really diverse habitats in it. But that doesn't mean it's still not a very beneficial resource to native flora and fauna. And the Asian carp, they're a huge problem. And these aquatic things, we talk about how difficult it is to rid terrestrial species, but in many ways the aquatic things are even more hopeless, I'm afraid. In many cases, once they get into an aquatic system, it's pretty much impossible to get rid of them.
Well, Fred Pierce, you've heard about these Asian carp, and if you haven't seen one, come on over sometime. We'll go down the river together and watch these things jump out of the river. People out here are really upset about these things. What about that? Are they an exception to the rule that you're talking about here when it comes to the threat of invasive species?
Well, they seem to be a problem for sure. I have seen one. I've seen a carp burger in a fish bar in Chicago. I've not seen one live. So maybe we should think about harvesting this stuff. You know, maybe if it's too late to get rid of them, maybe that's what we have to do. So we should think about some of these things as a resource sometimes. But I think the bigger picture here is that when one species kind of really runs riot, really causes a problem, very often it's because we've messed up the ecosystem and created ecological space, if I can put it that way.
And Fred, Larry's nodding his head as you're talking here. He's agreeing with your point. Absolutely. Keep going.
I mean, you know, we really messed up, you know, the Missouri and other rivers too. And it's often under those circumstances when the native species are not doing so well, they're finding it difficult too. And an alien species comes in, whether it arrives naturally or is introduced by humans or just escapes from somewhere. And suddenly, just occasionally, one in a million maybe, or maybe one in a thousand, they really take hold. But when that happens, I think we have to think, well, you know, what created this situation? And maybe blaming the alien species is not a very good thing to do. I come back to the point that I made at the start. Maybe this is nature's response. Maybe this isn't how nature is responding to the damage that we've done to the Missouri. And sure, that can be a problem for us. But in the bigger scheme of things, maybe that's nature doing its stuff. And maybe we should kind of step back a little bit and applaud.
That's,
you know, if nature's going to recover from the stuff that we're doing, maybe we're going to need more of these species.
Larry, again, from the Missouri Department of Conservation, this notion that Fred just threw out about using the Asian carp as a resource and maybe harvesting them, is that possible? I mean, is that a practical solution? Or maybe it is. I don't know.
Well, people are certainly looking at that. I think there's, I can't speak to it in depth, but I think there's a lot of logistical issues with harvesting them in mass. But they apparently don't taste awful, from what I understand.
Well, that's promising. Yeah.
I've always wondered myself if there wasn't a market for, you know, maybe fish meal as animal feed or fertilizer or something like that that could be utilized. I think we may see things like that evolve, perhaps. Fred makes an excellent point, and I just want to say, I mean, my job as a natural history biologist is my title, and my job is working with the best and least disturbed examples of our natural communities that we have left in Missouri. The places that are most like what the area looked like prior to European settlement. Mm-hmm. And it is important that we don't paint exotic species as necessarily bad in and of themselves, because it takes away, I think, from the ones that are truly a problem. Mm-hmm. And from my distinction, I have no issues with the ones that take over the extremely human disturbed areas. In many cases, it's the only thing that will live there. My issue comes when they invade some of these best quality natural communities we still have left.
Right.
The places
right.
that have the biological diversity. And that's where we need to draw the lines in the sand, and that's where we really put our resources toward battling them.
Lots of folks want to join our conversation here, and I've been late getting to them. Gloria from the Northland. Gloria, thanks for holding on.
Thank you. I'm so glad to have a chance to bring up this topic. I've lived in the Northland for 4 years, and it seems to me that every year I see more and more Canadian musk thistle. And it's along the roadways. There's quite a few woods in the Northland. And it's invading the edges of the woods. And in Kansas, when I lived in Kansas, that was considered a noxious weed. As a landowner, I could be fined for not ridding my pasture of it.
Mm-hmm.
I just wonder what the views of the naturalists and your professionals are about the musk thistle invasion.
Yeah, thank you very much. Ryan Armbrust, tell us about the Canadian musk thistle.
Well, that's one of those no-good, down-dirty plants that we certainly don't like. You know, it is listed as a noxious weed here in Kansas. I can't speak to the status of it in Missouri. I would expect that it may be noxious as well there, but certainly a species that, in my perspective, threatens more the production capacity of the land, because it's not going to be browsed by cattle. It's going to reduce the amount of forage per acre for those cattle, and certainly reduce the stability of that pasture ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. Larry, is the Canadian musk thistle on your radar screen?
Sure. That's actually kind of mixing two thistles. There's a Canada thistle, and I think she's just talking about musk thistle in general. And it's mostly something we see along roadsides, although it can invade good quality natural communities as well. That might be a good one to mention. We haven't talked about biological controls, which is something that is often used in the control of invasive exotic species, and that's one of the better examples. There's a musk thistle weevil that's been introduced on the landscape for a long time that has some benefit in controlling it. Even though it appears to flower, it's not producing any seed. So
mm-hmm.
if you're lucky, that weevil is present and might be keeping it in check. But those aren't a panacea. We could talk a little more about those if we had time. But
yeah.
It is a problem in Missouri as well, though. The MoDOT does a decent job in some places of getting on top of the musk thistle. That is one they try to control along state highways.
Well, gentlemen, we have a tweet here from someone titled, who calls him or herself the backyard ecologist, writes, "The Asian carp tastes great. Missouri Department of Conservation Online has your cooking videos for the Asian carp." So maybe there is an answer. Maybe Fred was right about a more productive use of that. Back to some calls. Let's go to Chris from Waldo, the Waldo neighborhood. Chris, good morning.
Thank you. I just wanted to bring the discussion the work of Douglas Tallamy, who wrote Bringing Nature Home, and spoke in the area recently at both here in Kansas City and Lawrence. His research shows that, by and large, non-native plants aren't predated upon or eaten by our insects to the extent that our natives are, so that when you have more non-native plants in your landscape, you have fewer insects, and 96% of our terrestrial birds feed their young on insects or insect larvae. So you see the why that is causing reductions in our native birds, and you know, it's also part of our insect species reductions, butterflies that we want to see. So you know, excluding agriculture, I just want to make the point of for everyone, including Fred Pierce, to read "Bringing Nature Home" by Doug Tallamy.
Okay, Larry, you're saying that's a good book. You're nodding here.
Yeah. Thanks, Chris, for bringing that up. And Doug has, I've seen his presentation as well, and it's excellent. And it does a really good job using insects as an example of how important it is that we look at a native plant and realize that it's evolved through many, many thousands of years with a number of different species. And that's the problem with many of the exotic species, is the speed at which they've been thrust upon our landscape.
Right.
That evolutionary time has not taken place, and they just don't support the same amount of life.
Huh. Dan from Shawnee. Dan, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Hey, Steve. Hey, gang. I love this topic. I think you could probably talk about it every day for 2 weeks and never really wear it out. But I just wanted to bring up that I've noticed that what we call an invasive species kind of depends on how we feel about the animal. And the example I would give would be the Burmese python in Florida. You know, everyone's freaking out about these things, like they're going to crawl up and eat your kids and take over the entire world. You know, the Everglades has been a destroyed ecosystem with hundreds and hundreds of invasive species for years. The python shows up and suddenly everybody knows what an invasive species is. Now contrast that with a pheasant, for example, or a house cat. There's millions of house cats loose killing native animals every year. There's groups like Pheasants Forever spending millions of dollars helping pheasants survive. Both of those are invasive species, or non-natives at least, but we don't call them that because we like them.
Dan, I'm glad you
throw that out there for you.
I'm glad you called. And Fred, one of the points in your book is that, you know, you point out that humans have played a huge role in the spread of invasive species. Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, nature has been moving, or has always been moving species around. We shouldn't get hold of the idea that none of it happened before humans were around, including transcontinental transfers. You know, a lot of insects move around in the guts of birds migrating or on driftwood going across the ocean. So nature's always been doing it. But we have undoubtedly increased the pace of it. You know, they're either deliberately or stuff that kind of hitchhikes with us as we go around the world. We mentioned ballast water before. That's a major method of moving marine species around the world. A lot of things come in with crops, for instance, or with movements of trees, that kind of thing. So we've undoubtedly speeded it up. But what I wanted to pick up on was the point that the suggestion that you know, native species are bad for, and alien species are bad for native insects. I'm not sure that that's true. In the UK, certainly not universally, in the UK here in England, most of our butterflies, most of our bees, massive amount of the sort of small critters in the landscape are now in urban environments where there are, and especially in people's back gardens, where most of the plants are invasive. You know, they're not native species at all. They've been brought in because they got pretty flowers or whatever. So I think we should be a bit careful of this idea that alien plants are going to be bad for native ecosystems. The evidence is not in general. I mean, I'm sure there are examples of that, but in general, the evidence is not that. The more the merrier. That the new species get along quite well,
right,
by and large, with the old ones.
Ryan Armbrust, Bill from Miriam on the Kansas side, writes us to ask this question. Are honeybees, I knew they would come up, are honeybees native to the U.S.? I'd heard not originally native, but he's not sure. What about that?
Yeah, they were brought in by Europeans. I mean, they came in hives. Before European honeybees showed up, most of the sweeteners were maple syrup in much of North America. While there were pollinators around before of insects and so on, a great deal of the pollination is now done by European honeybees. And you remember a few years ago, or still going on really, when there was that concern about how bee populations were being decimated by some disease, we weren't quite sure what it was. Mm-hmm. And suddenly everybody was looking at the economic cost of the disappearance of bee colonies. Well, you know, these are obviously economically very valuable alien species that have come in and been really very good for us.
Right. Well, Ryan, let me try this question for you. Julie emails us to ask, so if my 85-year-old dad ever gets stopped by the police while cutting down a wild red cedar on Clinton Parkway in Lawrence to use as his Christmas tree, he should tell them he's doing the ecosystem a favor?
He could certainly try. I make no guarantees that's going to get him, down to a warning.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd actually like to respond a little bit to the idea that some of the non-native species can be filling some of that same role as a host plant for some of the
yes,
insects.
Sir.
I've seen some very compelling data, and I'm really glad we brought up Doug Tallamy. He's got the book he wrote is fantastic, but he's got some very compelling evidence in there that another plant that I'm concerned about, the Calary pear, for instance, do some really good observations. They've found 3, 4, maybe 5 species of native insects and beetles and butterflies specifically that'll host on it. And you compare that to a choke cherry or a bur oak, which have been documented to have upwards of 400 or 500 insects on there. And these are an important food source for most of our birds. I am very concerned about the ripple effect we have as we have native species have a lack of regeneration due to some invasiveness of, say, bush honeysuckle or Calary pear as it shades out and actually uses allelopathy or really kind of toxic chemical warfare to suppress germination and regeneration of some of our native species. Are we going to see reduced insect populations? Are we going to see reduced bird populations? Mm-hmm. The ripple effects on some of these greatly concern me.
We're talking about invasive species here this morning on Up to Date. Our number, 816-235-2888. Dan from Kansas City, Kansas. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning. I live in the Beverly Hills area, which is along the Missouri River in KCK. I've been fighting.
You call it the Beverly Hills area, Dan?
Yes.
Like Beverly Hills is in California, but it's in KCK.
Actually, I think we may have predated that.
it's ours before it was theirs, right?
Well, this area goes back to 1854 when it was a territory, so I don't know.
Okay.
I've never really...
I just was curious. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Yeah.
No, not at all. I've been fighting the Asian bush honeysuckle for about the last 30 years, and of course I've been losing. I'm wondering, is there anything that's ever been tried about... using the plant's own biology against itself, kind of like the mosquitoes that they bred, the malarial mosquitoes that they bred in Africa to be neutered. Is there anything, or is that even a feasible thought that they could be, maybe a neutral one could be bred that would interbreed with other ones that... might at least slow down the...
Yeah. Larry Rizzo, take that one. Does that make any sense?
I'm not aware of efforts like that have succeeded with plants. I could be wrong, but that'd be a question for someone more of a horticulture background, I'm afraid. Oh. But it is I can certainly sympathize with how difficult that plant is to eradicate, yeah. However.
Go ahead, Ryan.
I was going to say, I maybe have a response to that. So on one hand, we get into the specter that they're dealing with actually with American chestnut right now, where's the line in a disturbed ecosystem where you attempt restoration or recovery by introducing a genetically modified organism? So that opens up an entire can of worms.
Mm-hmm.
And we can get into the philosophy of the proper role of humans in restoring human disturbed ecosystems. That's again, we could probably talk about that for 2 weeks every day.
Yeah.
But in terms of using the own plant's biology against it, there are actually some efforts in terms of control where one of the advantages that bush honeysuckle has is it leafs out early and keeps its leaves on later in the season. So it has sort of a time-based advantage over a lot of our native plants. And we can actually use that against it because late in the season, in November, it'll be about the only green thing out there in the woods, and that's a great time. You can use some sort of herbicide like a glyphosate to actually go out and control it because it's the only thing that's not dormant. So we can kind of turn its advantage against itself. And I've got to give a hat tip to a guy named Chuck Connor over at the Missouri Department of Conservation who's done some great work along that same path in trying to fight back against this bully honeysuckle.
Larry hopped in here. Hop in here, yeah.
Yeah, I want to thank Ryan for bringing that up. I work with Chuck, and you're absolutely right. There's a window for killing it that in November here in our area. I helped begin a nonprofit here in Kansas City called Kansas City Wildlands. And if people want to join the fight against invasive exotic species, they can look that up online. And we have public work days where people can come out and help us get rid of that. And our largest one is on the first Saturday of November where we target shrub honeysuckle on multiple sites around the city.
I
also say that we have an event in early December where we invite people to come to some parkland and harvest a cedar tree as a Christmas tree.
Oh, there you go.
One of the callers brought up. So that opportunity exists as well.
Just a real quick question here, Ryan. We have a Steve from Lawrence has written us to ask, the common dandelion, I heard that one woman from England brought it over here. Is that true?
I do know it's non-native, and I've found some fascinating pictures in archives. It was actually planted. You could buy the seed in pioneer days and plant it on top of your sod house for ornamentation. There's some amazing pictures of houses with, they're black and white, of course, but with a roof that has nothing but dandelions on it.
We're going to have to leave our conversation there, and I'm sorry to all our phone callers, Tim, Alan, Barbara, Faith, we couldn't get to all your calls. I want to thank a journalist, Fred Pierce, author of The New Wild, Why Invasive Species Will Be Nature's Salvation, Larry Rizzo with the Missouri Department of Conservation, and Ryan Armbruse with the Kansas Forest Service. Gentlemen, thank you all very much for your time. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Steve. You bet, guys.